Mr. James Craig, Reel 13. Now, you were just we just got to the point after the surrender of the Italian fleet.
Yeah.
Did you get to speak to any of the Italians?
No. We never actually, after we escorted the ships in, we didn't have anything to do with them at all.
So you escorted them back to Alex?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And what happened next, then?
Well, the next thing that I recall of importance was the invasion of Sicily. So we got detailed off and worked off, and we had been still supplying our own forces along the African coast. By this time, the Germans were just about finished as far as North Africa had gone. And the next main thing that I'd recall is the invasion of Sicily, which we took part in. In fact, it all, as far as I know, went according to plan, because the sector that we were given, we didn't see very much.
Yeah. It just went off without a problem.
Yeah. We were laying off and supposed to be... They'd gone by the time we got there. Yeah. There was very quiet. We didn't really see anything of it at all. Anyway, following the invasion of Sicily, one day we went through the Messina Straits when we crossed over to Italy proper, and we followed the army right up the coast as they advanced.
And what were you doing in support of the army?
Most of the time we were bombarding positions ashore when we were required.
That would just be the 4 point... I forgot what it is.
Four point seven.
It was just them that was firing, was it?
Yeah.
And what sort of targets would you be engaging?
They used to be miles away. You know, you didn't see them. We had a bombardment liaison officer, I think they called them. With us, whom we landed, and he would be in radio contact, and he would say fire required on such and such a map reference, which we would supply, and then he would say he'd make some corrections for us, say you're short or you're over 400 yards short or over. We make the correction in the guns, and then he'd say a few salvos, and they used to blast off a few salvos at the place, and he'd say target destroyed or fine or that's it. In fact, we lost a bombardment liaison officer. He got killed when he went ashore, and that was one of the casualties from the ship. The Faulkner, in fact, went through the war most of the time in all the actions. The Mediterranean, the Arctic, back to the Mediterranean, in the Atlantic, in the invasion of Normandy, and I think the casualties throughout the whole of the war were 6.
Which is very low, relatively.
Yeah. So that's why they call ships lucky. Yeah. It was 6 people. I think one fellow was shot by a sniper, Norway. Yes, he was in the boat's crew. He was shot by a sniper at Norway. The bombardment liaison officer. One fella had... Two had accidents. And 2 were washed over the side.
So what next?
We followed the army right up the coast. At night, we did anti-e-boat patrol.
Now, tell me about them.
In fact, when we got up as far as Naples, we were actually stationed on the Isle of Capri. used to be birthed in the Isle of Capri sometimes, which is all right, really, during the day. Yeah. Come night, you'd set off out and patrol up and down the coast, anti-boat patrol, to fend off any attacks on the invasion ships, you know, that might be mounted by the E-boats.
Did you sight any?
Yes, occasionally. We used to give chase. I don't think we ever had any success against them.
They'd be faster than you, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, aye. Oh, yes. Yes, much faster. Much faster. And then, of course, during the day, we'd also have spells where we were assisting the army with a landing, you know, with bombardments if required. Then, of course, from Naples, after they captured Naples, they opened the Anzio beachhead, which again was a bit rough.
Now, what do you remember of that?
The Anzio beachhead. They held the beachhead and they didn't get an immediate breakout, and we got severely bombed while we were in harbour supporting the army. We did a lot of bombardment at the Anzio beachhead. The Germans had started using glider bombs, radio controlled bombs, which instead of coming over and trying to bomb you, they laid off a bit and guided a bomb down.
What were they like? Did your ship, I mean, your ship wasn't hit, but do you remember these glider bombs?
Oh, yes, indeed. We were in what happened, after one or two ships had been hit by them, they decided that in harbour the best defence was to lay a smoke screen. If they couldn't see the ships, they couldn't glide a bomb onto them, you know. However, it didn't help the Janus, because she got a bomb down the funnel and blew up, one of the J-class destroyers, and the cruiser, the Spartan, was also hit by a glider bomb. One of the ships that was about to join in a few months afterwards was hit in the bows by a glider bomb. The whole of the bows came off and nobody got hurt. And it's reputed that there was even one of the sailors who'd gone in behind a drawn gun shield to have a quick smoke when he wasn't supposed to. He didn't even get hurt. The whole of the bows were blown off forward of the forward bulkhead. And they say that the anchor actually hit the crow's nest. So anyway, that was that's just before I joined HMS Jarvis. And the Anzio beachhead, it was rough, because not only did the use glider bombs and bombers, bombard, and we got the shore batteries firing at us as well. So we used to have a bit of a battle with them. We went in, there was one which came out at the end of a tunnel and pop out, fire at you, go back into the tunnel. So our captain, by this time, our captain had left the ship, and we was our captain was Lieutenant May. We had a lieutenant for the captain. I think his initials were T, Lieutenant T. May. Most excellent chap. I got on very well with him. He was our captain, so we decided to have a go at this gun that was coming out of the tunnel. So he went in closer and closer, and fired a few shots at it, and it shot out and started shooting it off, you know. As it was a narrow channel, we couldn't get out, so he went out astern and he made a signal to our companion ship. How do you like my Oscar Wilde withdrawal? Yeah, so that was it. Backwards. we spent some time on the Anzio beachhead. Then we ran some convoys back to Gibraltar. We got into Gibraltar.
From Alex or from?
No, from Anzio. We actually passed Mount Vesuvius, as it was erupted. And everybody in the bridge was looking at the eruption of Vesuvius through their binoculars, instead of looking out for E-boats and submarines and things, you know. But I thought was.
What did it look like? I mean, was it impressive?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You could see the lava flows coming down the side of the mountain, you know. Yes, it was quite impressive, yeah. Everybody wanted a loan of the binoculars to have a look, you know. Yeah, yeah, very impressive, yeah. Anyway, we got back to Gibraltar, and it's there that I left HMS Faulkner after 3.5 years and joined HMS Jarvis.
So you left her before D-Day?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Right, because you mentioned D-Day before. That was from the whole war you were looking at.
Yes,
the day, but you
yes.
left her earlier.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So you left her when?
Left her, that would be about April 44.
Now,
March, April, 44.
Why did you leave the ship?
Well, I'd been on for 3.5 years. And after 3.5 years, I thought, you know, we could do with a change, really. I was getting a bit, I don't know, fed up. I think...
You were a petty officer by then, weren't you?
Yes, I was, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I got... I got ashore in Gibraltar, and it used to be great in Gibraltar because you had lights on. Very occasionally you got an air raid from the Vichy French. All the lights are on. There was plenty of entertainment. There was places to go. There was cabarets and clubs and cinemas and, oh, fine, great. Even a bit of sightseeing if you wanted up the top of the rock, you know. So it was great. Everybody had a good time. Anyway, I sat. We had to go back and we were doing a boiler clean, HMS Faulkner, in the dockyard, which gives you a good few days in dock, you know. And I had gone ashore and I was having a drink in one of the night spots with the coxswain off another destroyer, and he said we've got to go to sea tomorrow and we haven't got a rain staker, he's gone sick. And I said I'm a rain staker, I wouldn't mind. What ship is it? He said the Jarvis. No, the nice J-class destroyer, they look smart, J's and K-class destroyers. And I think I'd probably had a bit too much to drink by then, and in a burst of empathy. I was sitting in this cabaret dance hall place talking to a chief coxswain from a destroyer. And he was from HMS Jarvis, and that's the ship that was telling you had the bows blown off and nobody hurt. And she was a lucky ship, too. She was known as a lucky ship, the Jarvis. Anyway, she was nice. The J-class were nice, smart destroyers. I think they were completed just before and as the war were beginning. They were very nice ships. So, in a burst of enthusiasm, alcoholic enthusiasm, maybe, and when he said he didn't have the range stick, and I volunteered to join the ship.
As a petty officer?
As a petty officer, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And was that okay? I mean, didn't your own ship want you?
Well, the next morning, I couldn't say I'd forgotten it, I remembered it, but I didn't think too much of it. I thought, oh, it was just beer talking, you know. I think we were drinking whiskey, actually. I think it was just the alcohol, you know. And after halfway through the morning, up the gangway, comes the gunnery officer from HMS Jarvis, who was a Dutchman called Glukins.
Glukins.
Glukins, I think it was spelled. Yeah.
So what happened?
And he saw our officer, the watch, and he said to him, "Where is this petty officer that wants to join my ship?" So they sorted out it was me, and the captain sent for me and said, "You know, do you really want to go?" I said, "Yes." I said, "I wouldn't mind a change after 3.5 years. Yeah, 3.5 years is a long time to be in one ship." I said, "Yes, I'm sure I'd like to go." So off I went.
But there was no other reason. It was just that you wanted a change. You weren't fed up aboard, or you hadn't had a row with anyone?
No, not really. No. I just felt it was time for the change. Time for a new challenge, maybe, because they were nice ships, those J's. And they had they had twin 4.7 twin mountings in the ships. You know, they had more modern armament. And,
well, tell me about that.
They were nice.
What was she like? Tell me about HMS Charles.
A lovely, sleek ship that looked fast with a single funnel and a real greyhound of the sea, as they call them, you know. Nice looking ships indeed. Sharp forecastle, a lovely stem, and single funnel, a lattice mast. Really nice.
So better than the Falkland.
Really nice. Oh, yes. Also, the accommodation was, it wasn't a lot better, but it was a slight improvement to the Falkland.
Now, were you in the petty officer's mess?
Oh, yes, indeed.
What was the petty officer's mess like?
Well, in both the ships, most of the destroyers, the petty officer mess was the bit on the B-gun. There was a section on the B-gun on the forecastle deck, which was the petty officer's mess. It was nice because you had portholes on either side. It could be a bit overcrowded, you know, in wartime conditions. The petty officer's mess is nice. You have a messman to look after you. He does the your food and everything, and looks after you. And the petty officers chip in a bit at the end of the month, the messman gets some extra money.
So what does he do for you exactly?
He keeps the petty officer's mess clean and tidy. He gets
that's
all your
where
food.
You sleep and everywhere, you know.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, he keeps it all clean and tidy, looks after it, gets our food for us and serves our food. And
would he do your kit as well?
No.
And wash your clothes?
No.
And was there more room on the petty officer's deck, or was it smaller? smaller. Less, more spacey individually, but a smaller deck, you know. Smaller mess, sorry.
Oh, yes, it's quite a small mess, yeah. Yeah, it's quite a small mess. When you look at the photograph of the ship, the superstructure underneath the B-gun deck is not huge. And, of course, at the fore end of your mess, you've got the support for B-gun coming down through your deck, you know, so there's a bit of a corner at the end. But it's quite comfortable, comparatively. You've got a big square. It's like, I suppose, the ordinary living room and lounge sort of stuck together, you know, maybe about 30 or 40 feet long and about 14 feet wide. And you've got
how many of you were there?
Well, the seamen petty officers, there was about 8 seamen petty officers. Then you had petty officer, telegraphist, signalmen, the ERAs were in there. On those older destroyers, all the senior rates, and slept and lived together. And later destroyers, he had separate messages for the ERAs and that sort of thing. But we had quite a selection there, I suppose. On the whole, there must have been about 24, 26, maybe more than that in there.
And just one messman?
Just one messman, yeah.
Now,
sometimes during the day, he'd get an extra hand in to help with the cleaning and that, just for the day job, you know.
So what happened for you? You joined, April 44.
April, yeah.
So what happened then?
The crew had thought, actually, when they got the buyers blown off at Anzio, they'd go home and have a nice refit at home. But in actual fact, they did it in Gibraltar Dockyard. We had a new captain had joined there, who was Roger Hill.
What was he like?
He was a great guy. He was one of the captains who had been in charge of a ship that was escorting the ill-fated Russian convoy, PQ-17, when they got the order. And he said he was so ashamed of having to leave the convoy, he'd never do the same again. And in fact, he was captain of one of the ships that took the tanker Ohio in, convoy Pedestal. And he stuck with the tanker, I think it was the Ledbury ship then. And he said, whatever happens, he stayed with the tanker and he escorted this damaged tanker into Malta. So that was him. He was a great guy. He was a nice fella. But I've read his books, and unfortunately, he's died now. But he got passed over for promotion. He didn't get on very well with the Captain D, I think, or something. And he was most upset because he got passed over for promotion to commander. He was a lieutenant commander. Anyway, that was Roger Hill. He took over the ship when she was repaired and being repaired in Gibraltar Dockyard. When the repairs were complete, we came straight back to the United Kingdom, and with a new crew, a new ship, everything, we went to Scapa Flow and did the usual working up exercises, gunnery exercises every day, damage control exercises, all sorts of things. You said that the ship had been damaged and the damage control parties had to do what they can to repair the ship, you know, and a fire in certain parts of the ship, and the exercise damage control, like firefighting exercises, only a bit more to it, you know, on the ship.
Damage. Does this involve the whole crew or the special teams who did it?
It's usually the special teams, So we had all these working up exercises and everything. And
had you got any new radar equipment? I mean, there's constant changes in equipment. Anything new?
They had the most up to date sort of radar equipment that was available at the time. They had good radar equipment there. Yeah. By this time, they had radar equipment installed that could spot a submarine conning tower, which is excellent. And of course, radio direction finding. The people on the radios could listen to the German submarines and track where they were actually sending from, and get a fix on them that way. So By the time we got to 1943, we hadn't beaten the U-boats altogether, but we had, in great measure, got control of them, you know.
Now, so what happened next? Your Scapa Flow?
Scapa Flow working up, Scapa Flow working up. By this time, we knew there was something in the offing. We went back to Portsmouth. Portsmouth was alive with Americans, tanks, everything, ships, landing craft, you know, huge array. Never seen anything like it, actually.
Did you realise what this was all for?
Yes, we had a good idea. We knew something was in the offing. Anyway, towards the beginning of June, they actually got the senior ratings of the ship and the people who were in the fire control and, you know, the essential people in charge of the various departments together, took us down the captain's cabin, locked the door and told us what was happening. And they got the map out and said, there you are, and there's all your targets on when they invade, and they're all mapped out. From then on, we weren't allowed ashore. We weren't allowed to go ashore, write letters, telephone, anything. We were more or less locked to the ship, you know. Anyway, I think we did that twice, in actual fact. And then, the day before the invasion, you had us down again and give all the gunnery people. And I found that interesting, me, because they had perfect pictures of the whole of the bit we were invading, with all the houses, gun emplacements, everything, all laid out on a map, you know. And not drawn, actual pictures, photographs, you know, of all where we were. And we, in fact, went in with the Canadian Division on the... I think we were on the second beach from the left, Sauld, I think it was. I'm not sure of the name.